code among recovering drunks. Most try to stick to it. The relationship between the sponsor and the sponsee is an emotional one based on trust between two equals. But we're only human. My dad and Penny were human, and they broke the rules. They weren't in love, and he was never trying to destroy our family because he'd found someone else. He simply went too deep and became just as vulnerable as the person he was trying to help. That's why the boys stick with the boys and the girls with the girls. My dad was the in-house counselor at his work and had been for years. He'd helped countless friends, strangers, and coworkers get into recovery, and he was great at it. But for the first and only time, with Penny, he broke the rules. He lied to my mom, and I've lied about him my whole life. Mom took Dad back before the school year started, and by Christmas, you couldn't even tell. We never talked about it. But out of all the things that went down in 1984, in that year that shaped so much of who I am today, both good and bad, the most significant event happened on May 24th in Guernsey, which is a small island in the English Channel off the coast of Normandy. That's when Catherine Holland was born, my Catherine. And in 2005, exactly 21 years, 1 month, and 5 days after I should have been at that Springsteen show, we met. She was a pair of shoes. I was about a week out from starting my first day in Entertainment Tonight Canada, a job I fought like hell to get, but didn't even know if I wanted. I was at a going-away party for a new coworker of mine who was leaving his old job at Much Music to come and work for us at ET Canada. The party was at the Government, a huge club down on the Toronto waterfront. I felt I had to be there. Attendance wasn't mandatory, but a ton of people from the new show were going, and I figured I should put on a suit, style up my brand new but boring ET Canada haircut, and try to bond. Or at least, show up. I was standing at the bar alone, doing what I did best, judging people for having fake fun and wishing I was anyplace else. I arrived by myself and had every intention of leaving the same way. I wasn't looking for anything, let alone a good time. I'd spent hundreds of nights in places just like this, lost and alone in the mayhem of a dance floor or making out with a stranger in a filthy bathroom stall. But those nights and that life was over, and I had zero connection to the person I was a decade before. I hated clubs now, and I hated going out. Club nights were now events, and always had some sort of promotional purpose attached to them, and nobody danced. They weren't fun anymore. The only reason anyone showed up to these parties was to hustle their way into the VIP area to look special, or to kiss the ass of someone with bottle service to look even more special, drinking $500 vodka Red Bulls all night that someone else paid for. This was one of those parties. Paris Hilton was in the corner, in her own roped-off section, on display, like she was for sale. A good 80% of the people there were only there to get in close enough to get a good look at her, catch her eye, and maybe grab a pic on their BlackBerry. I'd met Paris a year earlier, and we got along great and already had our moment, so I was hanging by myself in the back, in the dark, watching this shit show unfold in front of me, watching Paris build her empire one low-res BlackBerry fan cam pic at a time. "Hey, you're Roz, right?" "Yeah," I said, barely looking to see where the voice was coming from. But it's a good thing I made the effort, because if I hadn't looked down, I would have missed her. I'm 6'4", Catherine's 5'1", and this first conversation played out with a combo of me bending down a full foot and her popping up on her tippy toes to try and meet me halfway. Catherine looked like trouble, but the good kind of trouble. She was goddamn beautiful, the kind of beautiful that you quit your job for so you can stay home and stare at her all day. She had that chaotic energy that only 21-year-old dreamers have, and I immediately adapted to it and followed her lead because with Catherine, there is no other choice. I realized suddenly that I'd miss that energy and optimism that you don't know you no longer have until someone holds up a mirror. Catherine had on a pair of beat-up bohemian moccasins, tight-ass jeans, and a vintage rock and roll shirt with the sleeves cut off, and every time she put her hand on my shoulder to talk to me, I could see her bra as I bent my head down to listen. It was a great bra. The more we talked, the closer we got. And the closer we got, the more I realized she was something special. She wasn't looking for anything or trying to network. And she was just about the only person in that place who was actually having fun. Catherine was all the things I wasn't, and I knew that from the moment I met her. I didn't know how she knew me, whether it was a mutual friend or if she saw me doing dumb shit on TV wearing only bikini bottoms, but it didn't matter. I never asked. She was so kind and not yet jaded. She smiled at strangers and shimmied her hips to the music every time she took a sip from her straw. She was fun, which is something I hadn't been in a very long time. I'd stopped looking for fun and had zero desire to jump into another relationship, so I avoided places like this and women like Catherine. But I was all in that night. "What are you drinking?" I asked her. "Can I get you another?" Casual question. If she says yes, that means she wants to stay, I thought. "Please, say yes." "Water," she replied. "And yes, please." "Water," I thought. "You're locked in a room with 200 Paris Hilton superfans on a Wednesday, and you're drinking water." "Just water?" I asked for clarification. "Yep, just water," she replied and smiled. "It's too loud. Come with me," she yelled over the music as she grabbed my hand and her water and dragged me through the Paris Hilton mob, through a black curtain, into a deserted purple neon-lit VIP room. This was obviously the room they'd set up for Paris and her crew. It was tacky as hell, and clearly Paris hadn't used it. Catherine and I sat side by side in that empty room on a horrid silver fake leather couch, still holding hands. I finished the rest of my drink with my left hand because there was no way I was letting go. I was about to start a new job that I was nervous about. I still hadn't processed my dad dying, and I was technically still married, and I wasn't over any of it. I told her everything, in tiny bits, like some depressing highlight reel of the world's worst lava life profile. Within the first half hour of us meeting, Catherine already knew more about me than the people I'd worked with for years. I held nothing back, but she didn't flinch. She didn't ask any follow-up questions either. Nothing other than what was happening in this very moment was relevant to her. Where I'd been, what I'd done, or what I'd been through changed nothing. There was no judgment or hesitation. She just held my hand. "How old are you?" I finally got around to asking, while still hanging on tight. 21, she replied, with all the confidence of a 21-year-old. "So you were born in," I asked, trying to do the math. 1984. "Of course you were," I said just loud enough for her to hear me. "What does that mean, of course?" "Nothing," I answered. "It's a good thing. It's perfect. Love 84. It was a big year for me. I saw Springsteen for the first time." Lies. Nobody born in 1984 actually remembers 1984, and any love they have for it was something they had to learn on their own years later or from stories they were told. If Van Halen's 1984 was the best thing to come out of that year, Catherine Holland was a very close second. I knew that right away. "Do you want to get out of here?" she asked, suddenly squeezing my one big hand with both her small hands. "Yeah, we can do whatever you want, Panama." "Panama, what's that mean?" "Nothing. You'll figure it out," I told her. "Or I won't." Catherine didn't fuck around. "Where do you want to go? What do you feel like?" "I don't live too far from here," I said with all the hesitation of a 31-year-old who was in way over his head, but trying like hell to not look too old or too confident. "Okay, do you want to go not too far from here with me?" "Yeah, I'd like that. That sounds real great, Panama. Let me get my shit." "Still don't know what that means," she said. Track 3, side 1 of Van Halen's 1984. She had no idea, and I had zero game. That was my best. I was starting to sound old and douchey, but I was committed. I doubled down. "You'll figure it out," I repeated. "Probably not," she told me. Catherine wore my coat out of the club because she had a brand new nipple piercing and told me that she'd be screwed hard if it was even slightly cold outside. I remember when I first got my nipple pierced, It was 1991 by someone who used a thick sewing needle and had no business sticking anything into anyone, so I knew exactly what she meant. A rock-hard nipple and a fresh piercing is no bueno, she yelled over the music loud enough that the bouncer at the door tried to sneak a peek as we passed by. We held hands as we walked out, and she didn't even let go when she flagged a cab. I woke up the next morning still holding her hand with her curled up on top of me. I don't remember much of what happened when we left that club, but I do remember having the best sleep of my life. I hadn't had a good night's sleep in years, and she fixed that on night one. I don't know how, but she did. I wanted to thank her, but what woman wants to hear that? Thank you for putting me to sleep, even though it was the truth. Catherine was even more beautiful the morning after. She was uninhibited, but not a show-off. She had a history, but no sense of regret. And that morning, she sat naked with a coffee, curled up in the chair at the corner of my room, and didn't even ask for a robe or one of my oversized t-shirts to wear. I don't normally do this, I told her. I've never done this, she said with the type of honesty I wasn't used to. There was no awkwardness, walk of shame, or that empty feeling after a one-night stand. Catherine was the best start to any day I'd had in my whole life. Catherine was the first woman I'd been with in any serious way since my dad died. I wasn't looking for commitment, and up to this point, my perfect woman would have been an orphan dog owner, someone who had no hometown or family, so I wouldn't ever be asked to meet them or spend any amount of time with someone else's parents. I wouldn't have to bond with a father who wasn't mine. And a dog owner, well, because when you date a woman with a dog, no matter how much they want to stay, they'll always have to leave at sunrise without you ever having to ask. Catherine's parents lived 4 hours away in Ottawa, and she did have a dog, but this annoyed me more than anything else. I never wanted her to leave. This was also my first relationship since Taylor, who I was still married to. As I hadn't yet told the majority of people I knew that we'd broken up 10 months before, this very much felt like cheating. I didn't know how to do this out in the open, and I was so terrified of being judged. I didn't want this or whatever we were on our way to becoming to look like an affair that broke up my marriage, or people to think I went from first to second a little too fast. I didn't want to put Catherine in a position to be judged either. She was magic, and if anyone ever saw her as something other than that, it would have broken my heart. So I kept her and us a secret for as long as I could. My brother will tell you that for the first year Catherine and I were together, to him, she was a pair of shoes. Even though he and I lived together in a small townhouse, Catherine and Rich never met. He only knew she was there with me when he'd see her tiny boots by the front door as he left for work in the morning. Then I'd sneak her out while the house was empty, like we'd just pulled off a heist. Sometimes secrets are sexy. I'd spent too long confusing guilt and love. I still had this loyalty to Taylor, even though I knew whatever it was we'd had was long gone. There was no more us, but because it wasn't a clean break and we were still friends, I feared my moving on in any way would somehow hurt her. I felt terrible for wasting those years of Taylor's life. Our marriage was never going to work, and I knew that when we got married. I should have walked away, but I didn't. And now I was feeling like a shit person for moving on, even though I knew Taylor had already done the same. I felt like I still had that price to pay. Love and guilt are two very different things. Love is supposed to feel good. Guilt feels awful. But they both hit you in the same place. I had been consumed with so much guilt for so long that I couldn't tell the difference between what felt good and what didn't. I was just happy to feel anything, while also trying to make up for everything. I could never look objectively at any of my decisions. I could never separate the person who I knew I was from the choices I'd made. I took full responsibility for everyone else's feelings, but the idea of falling in love seemed way too much of an indulgence. It seemed selfish. Catherine and I were together maybe 3 months when she told me she loved me. I had started spending more time at her place and in her bed, always in her bed. She lived in a small bachelor apartment, so the bed was the only option, and I used it as an escape. Catherine didn't have some fancy job or a ton of money, but she spent everything she had on expensive bedding and things that made her place smell nice. Her bed wasn't big, and my feet always hung off the end, but it didn't matter. In her bed, with my head on her stomach, is where I felt most comfortable. Wrapped up in 800 thread count sheets and wrapped around her was the only place in the world I felt good about myself. But when I'd leave, that feeling would stay behind. I never took it with me because I wasn't strong enough to hold it. "I love you, Roz," she told me that night. She just said it. There was no lead up, no "we need to talk," no nothing. She just said it. And when I picked my exhausted head up off her lap and turned to look at her, I could see that she meant it too. But this was more of a statement, a matter of fact, than it was an invitation to say it back. My initial reaction was simple. "Don't," I told her. "Don't say that. Please, I'm not going to say it back to you. Not that I don't have incredible feelings for you, but I can't. I'm just not there. So please, just don't say that." I was almost begging, like this was going to be the beginning of the end. I couldn't move this fast. I couldn't move at all. And I knew this was going to fuck the whole thing up. I was comfortable in her arms and in her bed, but the idea of taking up space in her heart terrified me. "No," she told me. "What do you mean, no?" I asked. "No what?" "No, you don't get to tell me that. You can feel however you want. You can take your time or not feel anything at all. That's fine. But you don't get to tell me who I can love, and you certainly can't tell me what I can or can't say. You don't have to love me back, but I need you to hear it. For me, this is how I feel, and I want you to know that I love you, because it's the truth, and that matters." When you're the type of person who doesn't believe you deserve nice things, you do whatever you can to avoid them and push them away when they show up. When you feel like you'll never be able to return the good or give as good as you get, you consistently avoid doing all the things that would bring you closer to whatever idea of happiness you think only exists for everyone else. That was me. That's the person I was for the first 2 years Catherine and I were together. I was broken, and she was patient. Wildflowers. When Entertainment Tonight Canada started, we were a small crew that put together a big show from two rented wood-paneled mobile trailers that smelled like old cigarettes and fresh raccoon shit in the parking lot of the network building. This was the same building where I'd produced that talk show years before and blown $25,000 of their money on that trip to LA to meet a girl to be left stranded alone at a dildo store at 2 a.m. I kept that story to myself, even though the entire company had been bought and sold twice since I last worked there. They weren't paying me enough to pay them back, but the show wasn't making enough that I didn't think they wouldn't try. So I kept my mouth shut. This wasn't a flashy downtown media headquarters like the other places I'd worked. This building was in the suburbs, north of the city, and smack in the middle of a residential street. It was a pain in the ass to get there, but a trip that I was more than used to. The network had big plans for ET Canada and were pumping a ton of money into it. They were building us our own offices and a state-of-the-art control room. But until all that was done, we produced the show from the parking lot in the blazing heat with no personal space. I was sweating buckets through my borrowed suit as my thick, caked-on and layered TV makeup liquefied and dripped off the tip of my nose onto my desk when I was writing scripts. This was a glossy production, but I was far from a glossy guy. So the brilliant contradiction between how the show looked on TV and what it all looked like behind the scenes suited me just fine. I was a skid with a little bit of shine on him now, but I was still far more comfortable in that parking lot than I was on set of the show. The first meeting I had with my boss was when he made it clear why I was hired. "Interviews and voiceovers," he told me. That's all I need from you." I'd worked with the same exec producer when I was doing Last Call, so we had enough history that we could be somewhat honest with each other. But clearly, he didn't like me enough to give me anything more than a series of one-year contracts when everyone else was getting 2 and even 3-year deals. I had to constantly prove myself, continuously auditioning for my own job. "I need you to ask the questions nobody else will," he said. "I don't care what the rules are or what they're promoting. We ask what we want to ask, and we make news. That's what you do for this show. That's your job. These people aren't your friends, and we owe them nothing. They need us more than we need them." So that's exactly what I did. I spent the first 2 years of that show pissing people off while building a great reputation for getting people to talk about all the shit they said they wouldn't. This was the kind of structure and discipline I was looking for. I was a tool. I had purpose. But I wasn't proud of any of it. If Robert Downey Jr. was promoting a new movie, I'd ask about his past drug use and jail time. I'd go hard on people's relationships, their breakups, and their breakdowns. I said horrible things about Britney Spears during her 2007 head-shaving episode and have apologized for it publicly every opportunity I've had since. I'd unfairly ask about pregnancy rumors, how much money people made, affairs, weight gain, eating disorders, and anything else that might make some news and get us some press. My philosophy was, it was way better to have Lindsay Lohan pissed off at me for 5 minutes than have my boss pissed off at me for 5 days. One of my first trips to LA was to interview Colin Farrell. He had a new movie, Miami Vice, that he was promoting, but the big story was that he had recently and secretly married. This was huge for us. He chain-smoked for our entire interview, and in the final minute I said, "Can I ask you a personal question?" To which he replied, "Can I snuff this fucking cigarette out in your eye?" But because of his accent, his mumbling, and the 10 feet between us, I didn't hear any of it, and I asked the question anyway. He didn't answer, but I had to ask. That's all that mattered. These first few years at ET Canada, I was crushing it. I didn't love the job, but I was good at it. They hired me on as a senior reporter, but it wasn't long before I started doing all the work of a co-host, which in that world are two very different jobs. I was great on the teleprompter, showed up on time and prepared, and could always get the show back on track if we were ever running late. I was fast and didn't fuck around. I was consistent, dependable, and had amazing chemistry with Cheryl Hickey, the host of the show, who I'd known for years. I didn't mind my life as a reporter and really had no desire to be the face of anything, let alone ET Canada. But it drove me crazy that they used me as a co-host, but never let me forget that I wasn't. This had nothing to do with money either. It always felt personal to me. I obsessed over why I was never asked to co-host the show officially. I didn't particularly want the job, but I did want to be offered the job. My boss had absolute control over my life and future on that show, and when I asked him if he'd ever promote me to a co-host, he told me flat out, "No, never. You're just not dashing enough." He actually laughed while answering, like me thinking I could co-host this show was hilarious. He was right, though. I wasn't dashing. I was never going to be dashing. I didn't even like the word dashing. But for some reason, this all messed with my head and crushed my confidence. "I didn't hire you for your looks. You should be happy about that," he told me. I felt like that skid I had tried so hard to erase. And fat. I felt fat. I spent the next 4 months pounding Hydroxycut, an over-the-counter miracle weight loss supplement that years later was recalled and banned. According to the FDA, Hydroxycut presents a severe, potentially life-threatening hazard to some users. Although Hydroxycut-induced hepatotoxicity has been reversible in most patients, in certain instances, acute liver failure has resulted that has required liver transplantation to ensure survival. At the time, I didn't know any of this, but I knew it was wrong. It felt wrong, and I didn't care. I didn't have a weight problem, not even close. I had a self-image and confidence problem. I'd always hated my body, but now I was pissed off. I was going for the kind of drastic change that a new haircut and a few hours in a tanning bed wouldn't even come close to achieving. I was ashamed. I didn't keep the pills in the bathroom vanity or in the medicine cabinet like any normal medication. I kept the bottles in my sock drawer, hidden and buried so deep it was a pain in the ass for even me to find them every morning. But they were working, doing exactly what they were designed to do. Fix the outside, and destroy the inside. Our wardrobe stylist was taking the waist of my suit pants in an inch every couple of weeks. I shaved all the hair off my body, ankles to neck, so I could better see the progress, and would stand naked in front of my full-length mirror in my dressing room for 20 minutes every morning before getting dressed for the show. After routine blood work, my doctor called me at 9 one night. He had never called me personally before. I'd only ever talked to his assistant or one of the nurses at the clinic. He told me he was testing me for hepatitis and asked big questions about my family history and if I'd traveled anywhere sketchy recently and needed to know if I was taking PCP or ketamine in large amounts. I was 6'4", 146 pounds, and my liver enzymes were off the charts. I was killing myself with diet pills in some stupid quest to prove I was dashing to a person I wouldn't have taken the morning off work for had he dropped dead. I knew what was hurting me, so I stopped taking the pills and played dumb. I lied. My second round of blood tests, about 5 weeks later, came back totally normal. It was a miracle. I found a new doctor and stopped watching myself on television. I haven't seen an episode of ET Canada since. For about a year, early on in the show, Suri Cruz was the most famous baby in the world, and the show paid an obscene amount of attention to her. A baby. For months, it didn't matter who we sat in front of or what they were promoting, we had to ask every interview what they thought of the baby. If you were a TV chef promoting your cookbook with zero connection to Tom Cruise or Katie Holmes, or if you were the bassist for Metallica, if you were on our show, you're goddamn right you were going to talk about the baby. Our boss was obsessed. I was assigned to interview Penelope Cruz, which was a huge deal, as she dated Tom right before he and Katie were married. Penelope was an actual connection. She was Tom's ex, and a comment from her would blow the fuck up, I was told. My boss sent me in to do what I was hired to do, and nothing more. The script for the show was already written. I had no choice. They created big, flashy graphics with the word exclusive in huge, shiny font, and everything was ready to go. Did I really want to ask a woman about her ex-boyfriend's new baby? No. But that's what I was hired to do, so that's what I did. No personal questions, her publicist told me as I sat down. No relationship questions, no games, stick to the movie. Yeah, of course, man. No problem, I reassured him. I was an expert at lying to publicists. I was a huge fan of Penelope Cruz, though, and under different circumstances, I think we probably would have had a lovely chat. Her movie was really great, but none of that mattered, because the baby. I don't remember if Penelope Cruz stopped the cameras or if they were still rolling when this happened, but I do remember our interview ending early with her hunched forward in her seat, her finger pointing at my face, darting closer and closer after every word as she cussed me out in a lightning-fast combo of English and Spanish. To be honest, it could have been one or the other. I don't remember, because I wasn't listening to a word of it. The only thing I remember wondering as she rightfully read me the riot act for that gross overstep was, did she say the word happy before going off on me? If she said the word happy, like she was happy for Tom, we could run that. We could isolate that one word and build an entire show around it. That's the exclusive. I didn't apologize or try to justify the questions I asked. And I didn't even stand up or say thank you when she stormed past me out of the room. I'm pretty sure she said happy, I thought. I fucking hope she did. I felt horrible after that interview, but I got high fives when I got back to the studio with the tapes. I left the office that night around 6, feeling gross about myself. I took the same two buses, a subway, and a streetcar back downtown to Catherine's tiny apartment. How was your day? How was the show? She always asked when I walked in. Fine, I'd say. That was the only way I ever described my day. Fine. Then we'd flop on her bed on those incredibly soft sheets she couldn't afford as she quietly sang along to whatever was playing, usually something by Bob Dylan. I put my head on her stomach, close my eyes, and fade into her while she ran her fingers through my hair until I was me again. I didn't want to break up with Catherine, but I had to. Most of the truly horrible decisions I've made in life, like this one, have been based around the same made-up mathematical equation that has no specific formula or defined rules. It goes like this. I take all the people I've hurt. Add that to all the people who have hurt me. Then I know exactly how much I need to hurt myself. Do you know how much you have to dislike yourself to dump a woman like Catherine, who is pure fucking joy, optimism, and kindness, for someone who tells you you're so worthless that when you're not around, me and my friends call you Peso, like some cute nickname? That's where I was at. That's what I did. I started feeling guilty, like I was taking advantage of Catherine and her kindness. We were in love, and it was crushing me. I knew where this was going, and I couldn't handle the weight. In the years we were together, Catherine never asked me to define myself or our relationship, but I could feel that we were getting to a point where that wasn't going to be good enough for too much longer. Not for her, but for me. Her patience was my anxiety, and she deserved more. She was worth all the work it would take for me to start putting the pieces back together again. But people started to look at me like I was a big deal now. I was on national TV. I had an audience and free clothes, and people seemed to love my flirty, awkward, and brutal interviews. And as much as most of what I did made me sick to my stomach, I did love the attention. I didn't mind being that guy. That guy felt nothing. But I wasn't that person around Catherine. Catherine was genuinely proud and encouraging. But if I stayed, I was gonna burn it all down. I couldn't be both people, and I wasn't ready, even after all this time, to process the loss of my dad or anything else. If I started to fall apart now, I'd lose it all. I didn't know how to be happy, but I was an expert at being a fraud. So I ran. I started to put space between Catherine and me and began to undo all her hard work. Travel became my new distraction. I was more comfortable alone in a hotel room in a city I'd never been to than I was at home or in Catherine's bed. I told our assignment editor to just send me anywhere. It didn't matter where. Just keep me on the road, I told her. The UK, LA, New York, Aruba, all over Mexico, northern Alberta, southern Florida, Egypt, Rome, Vancouver, Chicago, Moscow, Paris. I'd be gone for weeks at a time. I felt if I ran far enough, I'd find what I was looking for. On one of those trips, I met a writer from back in Toronto who was covering the same story for the paper she was working for. Nothing happened between us on that trip, but I could tell we had a connection. I probably paid a little too much attention to her, and she definitely didn't mind. She looked at me like I was someone else, someone I clearly wasn't, but was already interested in becoming. Being that guy felt good. It felt easy. She didn't care about my story and never asked me to open up. She was into fashion and fancy shit that I didn't know anything about. I still don't know what couture means. I never once saw her wear the same thing twice. She had rich friends. She was popular, had beefcake male models blowing up her inbox way before Instagram, and clearly had never waited in line for anything her whole life. The polar opposite of anyone I'd ever been with. She was the exact kind of woman who would never date a skid like me. But she never met that guy. She didn't know my life or where I came from and didn't ask. And she was never going to ask. This woman was going to hurt me. And I went all in. At first, we really did have a few good days. Her friends seemed to like me. We had a couple of fun nights out. And I'd always do my best to take note of what I did on those days, to make sure I didn't do anything to piss her off the next day. She was super easy to piss off and could easily freeze me out for 2 or 3 days at a time, making me work my way back in. The good days started to fade and then became non-existent. What I was chasing were the days that weren't just total shit. I convinced myself that a not total shit day was actually a good day because the bad days had quickly become volcanic and cruel. But there were no more good days. 2 months into our relationship, I was so beaten down that I was taking Viagra just to be able to sleep with her because nothing worked. Nobody has ever made me feel worse about myself so fast. Then we'd have one not total shit day where I'd feel like I was her entire world, and the whole wicked cycle would start all over again. I'd call her friends to ask what I was doing wrong. Everything, one of them told me. You're doing everything wrong. Last week at brunch, you made a joke about blowing your nose in your hand in the shower and pushing the booger down the drain with your big toe. That sounds like something I'd say, I thought. She dumped a guy for that. Excuse me? For blowing his nose in the shower. How do you not know that? How would I know that? She needs a man, another friend told me. You need to get your driver's license. We think it's weird that you don't have one. She said this like they were all part of some collective hive. That was the truth, though. I was 34, and I'd never driven a car. I never got my license because I was afraid I was going to kill somebody. But how could I admit that to the most judgmental person I'd ever met? My Tourette's had progressed over the years and was cranked up by the amount of stress I was under. It was made especially bad by having to be awful in interviews but flawless on TV. I'd gone through a few years now where all my tics were in my eyes. I would blink rapidly, squint, or roll my eyes back into my head. I didn't trust myself to drive a car because one tic could take me out of the world long enough to miss something. I worried if I lost even a single second when I should have been paying attention, I'd cause an accident. I was afraid I would kill somebody. I never mentioned my Tourette's to her, and I wasn't planning to either. If you want her, you have to fight for her, the friend instructed me. I want you to win. I'm on Team Roz over here. I didn't know this was a competition. We were in bed one night at my place when I saw her texting someone because she thought I was asleep. Be home soon, were the words I read from the corner of my eye. I asked to see her BlackBerry. She refused, even though she went through mine every night before we went to bed. I need to know I'm your boyfriend, I told her. I was ready to fight for us. I need to be more than just another guy in your phone. I'd never tried this hard with a woman before, but it wasn't about love. It was about validation. I felt like shit, but I was in too deep and had walked away from whatever life I'd lived before her. This was it. I wanted to become the exact thing she needed, a whole new person. I needed to win and tried to prove my worth by being able to take whatever toxic abuse she threw at me more than anyone else. This was a fight I knew I could win. Do you know how hard this is for me, being with you? She asked while I was still lying naked on top of her. Do you realize that every time I kiss you, I have to close my eyes and pretend you don't have those tattoos, that haircut, or all those bracelets? You're not my type, Roz. I told you that. But I'm really trying here. What more do you want from me? She finally saw me for the skid that I was. Asshole, is what I thought. I love you, is what I said. And I didn't mean a word of it. What I should have done was gather up whatever self-esteem and pride I had left and walk the fuck out of her life, giving her the finger from the end of one of my bracelet-filled wrists. What I did do was start wearing long-sleeve shirts to cover up my tattoos and put every bit of rock and roll jewelry I had in a box under my bed. I tried to do better. On one of those bad days, when she hadn't returned my calls for a full 24 hours, I had a few drinks while out and then wandered next door into a tattoo shop to get a small heart done on the inside of my middle finger on my left hand. It didn't really mean anything, but heart tattoos are always pretty. Also, I wasn't burning myself anymore, and the process of getting a tattoo reminded me of that feeling. If I walked past a shop that had an open chair, I'd ask if I could go in for a quick touch-up on one of my older tattoos, just to feel the needle darting in and out of my skin. I knew the tattoo would piss off my girlfriend, but I did it anyway. The heart tattoo took all of 10 minutes. Then I walked back next door, ordered one more drink, and settled up the bar tab I'd opened before I left. Our entire relationship lasted maybe 5 months. I knew it was going to end and it wasn't going to end well. It was only a matter of time. The last time we talked was when I found out she was also dating a friend of mine the entire time we were together. She had a whole second boyfriend. They went home for the holidays that Christmas, back to her parents' house, and he got to meet her family while I was at her place, back in Toronto, putting together her new bed frame and reorganizing her closets. I've listened a lot in my life. Listening is the one skill that has helped me more as an interviewer, entertainer, and person than anything else. But I've never listened to the universe, not in any sort of Oprah higher power kind of way. I'm not religious, I don't remember my dreams, and I've never looked for signs. I've never been that guy. I wouldn't even know what to listen for anyway. I don't believe in fate or that everything happens for a reason, and I still have no clue what it means when Mercury is in retrograde. I've never once taken my guard down long enough to surrender to anything, and the only whispers I've heard were my own, bouncing off the inside of the walls I built around me. But if it was the universe and Paris Hilton that brought Catherine and me together the first time, maybe the universe could do it again. I called Catherine right after I ended that relationship, like the same night, maybe an hour later. I'd spent so long hurting myself that I didn't once think about how it affected anyone else. I'd never gone back or even looked over my shoulder to see what I was leaving behind. I was self-destructive and self-centered, which always does as much damage to the people who love you as it does to yourself. But I was done. I was done hurting myself. Catherine picked up the phone and asked me if I was okay, if I needed help. She knew. There was no lecture, no yelling, no guilt. No price to pay. Can I come over? I asked. Of course, always, she told me. Catherine didn't look at me like I was someone who broke her heart or an ex-boyfriend who'd showed up to beg for a second chance. She welcomed me in like I was a teenage runaway who'd finally made his way home, defeated and lost, or an addict fresh out of rehab after a relapse promising this was the last time, again. She was kind, but rightfully cautious. There was no big hug, but she did take me by the hand, like she had that night we met, and led me to the couch. She was in a new apartment now, and I didn't know my way around. What happened? She asked me, while still holding my hand on her lap. As I sat there, trying to put the words together, I looked down at her fingers, intertwined, both of her hands on top of one of mine. What is that? I asked. What is what? She answered. I had to wiggle my hand free to make sure my eyes weren't fucking with me. That, I asked again. When did you get that? Oh, the tattoo. Maybe a couple of months ago. It was a small heart on the inside of her middle finger on her left hand. I slowly opened my left hand to show her mine. They were identical. What? Her eyes opened wider than I'd ever seen them, and Catherine has big eyes. When did you get that? She asked. A couple of months ago, I told her. Now, tell me, if that wasn't the universe, then what was it? How do two people who hadn't talked in months, but who were still so obviously in love, go off and get the exact same tattoo in the exact same spot at the exact same time? Like, are you fucking kidding me? After talking for hours and me telling her everything, we spent the night together. I was too exhausted to head home, and I didn't want to leave anyway. I don't think she wanted me to either. I had the second best sleep of my life that night. We woke up naked and started the day slow. There was no awkwardness or remorse. I loved this woman and was never going to push her away again. I just didn't know if she wanted me. I hurt her more than I'd ever hurt myself, and I was never going to hurt either of us ever again. I wanted to heal. I took the week and tried to put everything together in my head, everything that I wanted to tell her. Catherine came over the following Friday, maybe 8 or 9 days after that night at her place, and I took her by the hand and I led her into the living room. I'm going to stand, if that's okay, I told her. I've got tons to say. I'm probably going to ramble and pace around, but please hear me out. I'm going to try to make all this shit make sense. Please let me try. The ceilings in my place were tall and my couch was huge and Catherine looked so small sitting there alone, but she sat up straight with her shoulders back, confident as hell. She never broke eye contact. All right, she told me. I'm not going anywhere. I never stopped loving you. I said right out of the gate. I was never not in love with you. I needed her to hear that first. And I needed her to know that I meant it. I talked for 3 or 4 minutes, waving my hands around like a maniac while walking rings, perfect circles, into the rug. Catherine never said a word. She just listened. I tried as best I could to explain that, yes, I was a little bit broken, but I was not ruined. I just hurt all the time. I let the things that hurt me continue to hurt me every day. But I was done. No more. I think about dying all the time, I told her. I still felt so much guilt over the way I handled those last few months when I still had my dad. That is, death put me on the clock, and I'd lost sight of the purpose of all of this, of being alive. Awful things happen to really good people, to all of us, but none of it, none of the hurt, abuse, or cruelty from the past should define who we are today. I just want to fill a house full of love and see what happens, I told her. And when it's the end, when it's my time to go, there's only one person I want by my side, holding my hand and telling me good night. It's you. It's always been you. Do you mean that? Catherine asked me, finally breaking her silence and eye contact. Every word. I've never meant anything more in my entire life, I told her. Good. Because I'm pregnant. I dropped to my knees and cried. I crawled over to the couch, sat on the floor in front of her with my head on her lap, and cried. I cried harder than I had in my entire life. Every tear from every time I should have cried but didn't came pouring out, and they haven't stopped since. I can't say that I cry every day, but I do almost cry every day. And on the days when it does happen, it's beautiful. It's a recharge. It's always the exact thing I need at the exact time I need it, like a rainstorm finally hitting a field of wildflowers after a long, dry summer. That's what we were going to be, wildflowers, beautiful, full of joy, and free, strong enough to grow through concrete and resilient enough to thrive under whatever punishing conditions came our way. I learned to love the rain that night. I guess I should man up and get my driver's license, huh? I said when I finally stopped crying enough to put a few words together. Why? Catherine asked while wiping her own tears from her chin. So I can take the kid to karate. Nah, I can drive us. We can go as a family. A family of wildflowers. The best decision I never made. How do you replace everything? That right there is the question I've asked myself almost every day since my dad died. It's an overwhelming and impossible thought. Of course, you can't actually replace the people you've loved and lost. Not my dad, anyway. He was irreplaceable. When someone dies, they leave things behind. And at the start, those little reminders are the ones that hurt the most. You miss their voice, their laugh, their smell, and their hugs. You miss their advice and the way they said your name. You miss the fun. You take months to finally clean up the puzzle in the basement on the folding card table that they never got to finish, and you leave their slippers by the front door right where they left them. But after a while, I realized that Dad's stuff was just stuff, and that it wasn't even his laugh, hugs, or unfinished stories that I missed the most. It was the space he occupied in the world. When someone dies, the world keeps spinning, with all of us on it, and that empty space is what you feel the most. That's what always hurts. It's almost cruel. That was his spot. So was that. And my dad's space in this world, the one he occupied with strength, pride, compassion, and fart jokes, was empty. And that's what killed me for years. The void. When he died, the world lost a great dad. But that night Catherine told me she was pregnant, everything finally made sense. I finally got my answer. How do you replace everything? Well, you can't. I knew I couldn't replace my dad, but I could fill his space. This kid was the best decision I never made, and I was going to even everything out. The world lost a great father when my old man died. I was going to give it another one. Mom was still living on the East Coast with my grandmother, both of them trying to not kill each other, and Catherine's whole family, who I'd met once, were in Ottawa, about a 4-hour drive away. Neither of us had a large group of friends, and none of the friends we did have had babies of their own. So there was very little outside influence, which suited us perfectly. Catherine was building our kid, and we were building a home, and we did it all our way. We bought a few baby books, like everyone does, but I didn't read a single page. The only people I wanted telling me about this pregnancy were our doctors and Catherine. Catherine became the teacher, and I became the student. Hey, did you know that I'll be pregnant for 40 weeks? That's 10 months. What kind of fuckery is that? Who started the 9 months hoax? She yelled at me when I was making her 100th ham and cheese on a ciabatta one night early on. Also, in 3 weeks, I'm going to be growing hands and fingers down there, so I'll be busy that day. Don't book anything. That sounds like a shit ton of work. I'll probably need like 2 naps that day. I'm not sure Catherine had ever even held a baby before she was pregnant with her own, but she became an expert, and I listened. I didn't want to ever come at her with my own info from something I read or try to explain what I thought was going on with her body. I wasn't absent or uninterested, the exact opposite, actually. But we knew very early on that there were parts of this that we were going to go through together and others that she was going to handle on her own, like the puking part. If I can offer one piece of advice for first-time fathers-to-be, it's that you have to have the puke conversation with your girl. Have it early and establish the rules. Catherine is one of the greatest pukers I've ever met, the complete opposite of me. Whether it's the flu, mild food poisoning, the rare times she's been drunk, or pregnancy, Catherine pukes with such ferocious efficiency and speed that it's actually impressive. Usually, it takes no longer than it would to walk into the bathroom and blow her nose. Then she'll be back on the couch, sipping a tea, like nothing happened. But the sound. My fucking God, that sound. I've never heard anything like it. It's violent and aggressive, like she's being run over while drowning, or having her hips broken with a cricket bat and throwing away old soup. It's demonic. Catherine didn't have morning sickness. She had all day, maybe we shouldn't leave the house today sickness. And it was so very loud. I need to know what you need from me when you're in there, I said after the first time it happened and I heard what I heard. I was paralyzed, in shock, and ready to call 911. Do you need me to come in, hold your hair and rub your back? What do you need me to do? Nothing, she replied. I need you to pretend it's not happening. You don't hear anything. Can I turn the volume up on the TV, or is that too rude? Do you want me to pause our show or keep watching? I can leave. Do you want me to leave? These rules were important. Do not pause anything. When you hear the toilet flush, just rewind to wherever it was before I went in. I can do that, I told her. And that's what I did. I'd listen for the flush, then the sound of her electric toothbrush, and then I'd hit rewind and wait for her to walk out of the bathroom, always amazed she still had both her arms because it really sounded like someone just sawed them off in there. She'd flop on the couch, and I'd hand her tea, kiss her on the shoulder, and tell her I loved her. Then I'd press play, and we pretend none of that just happened. We never talked about it. Catherine and I were building our house of love, one that we also shared with my brother Rich and his now fiancé, Leanna. But we loved them too. Catherine and I hadn't ever lived together, and when she did move in, she was already pregnant, so it was game fucking on. We weren't dating, we were a family. Rich and I were about 2 years into living in a big 100-year-old Victorian house that we bought with the money we made off the townhouse. The previous owner of the place had used the entire main floor as an art gallery and moved all the home stuff, like the kitchen, bedroom, and full bathroom, up to the top 2 floors. It was perfect for us. Rich and Leanna took the upper floors, and I spent the first year after we moved in renovating the main floor for myself. It was a blank slate, and I turned it into the perfect bachelor pad. 1 bedroom, huge living room, and a bar. This house was not built for a baby. Hell, this house wasn't built for Catherine. Glass top coffee tables, hard as hell limestone floors, poured concrete countertops with sharp edges, and everything was built up. I didn't want the kitchen to take up too much space, so I stacked everything high. And because I'm so tall, it was perfect. For me. The upper cabinets were doubled, two full rows on top of each other, all up the 10-foot ceilings. Catherine had to use a step stool just to get a coffee mug. "I'm going to rip it all out," I told her. "We need a second bedroom. Babies don't shower, so we'll definitely need a tub. And how are you going to feed this kid when you can't reach any of the food?" I was still paying off the first reno from 2 years ago, but was ready to do it all again. "No, you're not ripping anything out," Catherine replied. "We're fine. We need a changing table, a bassinet beside the bed, and the sink is more than big enough for a bath. We're not buying things until we need them. I don't want to have to sell a mini dresser or a mini anything else in 6 months just because we thought they were cute at the time. But the glass coffee table has to go. That thing will kill a kid." Catherine has always had a way of slowing me down. The only thing our house needed was love. And a baby gate. She did let me buy a baby gate. Catherine found two old pictures of my dad in a box in the basement and framed them and put them on a shelf in the living room one day when I was at work. Until then, there were no reminders or memories of my father in my house, except for his cardigan on that far left side of my closet. But these weren't pictures of my father when he was my dad. They were of him when he was younger. Looking at those pictures every day was like looking into a mirror. In those little frames, I saw someone who, despite having gone through hell, only wanted to do his best. He was flawed but determined, a man with secrets that would eventually become great stories, and one who was built for fatherhood but didn't yet know it. Those two pictures sit on that same shelf in those same frames even today, and they're still the only two I have of them. Everything. In the summer of 2009, my family life was better than I could have ever imagined, but I still felt off about my career. Like I had more in me that I wanted to do. I just didn't have a place to do it. Catherine and I were in sync, crazy in love, and about 6 months away from becoming parents. We were having the time of our lives and would spend most of our evenings laughing until I cried and she peed. We were a wild and free army of two, soon to be three. Also, I was about to sign my first multi-year deal with ET Canada. The show had gone through some major changes, but so had I. I wasn't being asked to be shitty in interviews anymore, so that was good. There were no more invasive and gross questions and no more lying just to get me in the room. And we, as a show, moved on from obsessing over or running pictures of celebrities dropping their kids off at daycare. But I was asked to flirt. They loved a flirty interview. I'd be assigned to interview every young female star in hopes there'd be some kind of connection that played out in the 4 minutes we had together. That kind of shit didn't often happen naturally, so I'd have to force it most of the time. When it worked, it worked. "That was gold," they'd tell me, or "she really loved you." When it didn't work, it really fucking didn't. But they'd always cut around it in editing, and the worst bits would never see the light of day. I didn't know it then, but years later, those would be the interviews that would come back to haunt me, not the ones where I was digging too deep or getting shut down or walked out on. Other than those interviews, I was having fun. Patrick Swayze showed me how to air hump while teaching me the dance from Dirty Dancing. I rode a camel through the Egyptian desert, then crawled down to the tombs beneath the Great Pyramid of Giza. I've done high kicks with Liza Minnelli, hugged Carrie Fisher, and witnessed Alec Baldwin verbally destroy an assistant over the phone, spitting venom and profanities at a volume I didn't think was possible while I sat quietly waiting for him in the next room. I watched the Super Bowl in Rome, made Al Pacino laugh, and discovered Steve Carell is one of the nicest people you'll ever talk to, and Adam Levine is not. I got to interview every single action hero and rock star I idolized as a kid. For most people in the business, this was a dream job, but I needed more. As wonderful as ET Canada was for me, I felt constricted. I still spent most of my day wearing clothes that weren't mine while standing in front of a teleprompter, speaking words I didn't write. On June 25th, I'd taken the day off and was with Catherine at a doctor's appointment when I got a call telling me to be on standby to come in because Farrah Fawcett had just died. This one hit hard. She was an icon, and I cherished my Farrah Fawcett poster when I was a kid, the one where she's in the red bathing suit, which hung right next to my Lonnie Anderson poster, also in a red bathing suit. I told work that I needed a couple of hours, but would be free if they needed me after that. Then, 4 hours later, my phone exploded. I'd stepped away for 30 minutes, and I had 26 missed calls. The first email I checked was an open-ended ticket to Los Angeles, and the flight was leaving in less than 3 hours. Michael Jackson was dead. I always kept a carry-on bag half-packed and ready to go. It had a toothbrush, hair dryer, makeup bag, pair of shoes, 3 pair of socks, and 4 pair of underpants stuffed in there. There was never any scrambling on flight day. I'd grab my passport, a couple of shirts, and a suit, then kiss my girl, and I was out the door. I was at the airport less than 30 minutes after getting that email, and it's a 20-minute drive. When you travel as much as I did, people just assume you love it. I lived every weekend like I had just scored the grand prize on The Price is Right. You've just won an all-expenses-paid trip to Hollywood, California, staying at the luxurious Four Seasons Hotel in beautiful Beverly Hills, where you'll attend a red-hot red carpet movie premiere, rub shoulders with the rich and famous, and dine at world-renowned five-star restaurants. We'll also throw in $75 a day to go on that shopping spree you've always dreamed of. This was my life every week, and I cannot stress enough how much I had grown to hate it. Not to mention the fact that $75 wouldn't even cover breakfast at the Four Seasons. I just hated everything about traveling. I hated being away. I hated being alone. And I hated flying. I'm not afraid of flying. I just don't fit on airplanes. Over the years, I had spent as much time building contacts and making friends with key people at all the major airports as I did on my actual job. The goal was to always get upgraded to first class. As soon as work sent my ticket, I'd start working my contacts. For anyone who's never flown first class, let me break it down for you. The difference between first and coach goes way beyond the bigger seat, free wine, and warm cookies. If you manage to get yourself on the other side of that curtain, you'll discover that first class isn't about the in-flight service. It's about how you're treated as a person. If the seatbelt light is on and you get up to go pee during mild turbulence in the back of the plane, a flight attendant will literally put their thumb in the middle of your forehead to push you back down in your seat. If that same thing happens in the front of the plane, one of them will take you by the hand while the first class cabin crew lock arms and form a human chain to make sure you get to the bathroom safely. That's the difference. You're a first class person. Gabby was my contact in Toronto, and as soon as I got to the airport that day, I started texting her. She'd worked for the airline for 25 years and knew all the tricks. If she couldn't find me a seat, she would always hack the system and try to bump someone else out. The airport was madness that day, and the customs line snaked all the way back through security. Gabby texted back asking where I was and telling me to hurry. She couldn't get me upgraded on my flight, but there was another flight leaving for LA in 20 minutes that she could get me on. "I'll do my best, but I can't make this line go any faster," I texted back. There was at least 200 people ahead of me. I wasn't going to make this flight. All anyone could talk about in line was Michael Jackson dying, and the people who recognized me from the show knew exactly where I was headed. "Michael Jackson?" one woman asked. "Yep, Michael Jackson," I replied without looking up from my phone, still furiously texting Gabby. "Thanks, Gabby, but I'm not going to make it. I appreciate you trying," I wrote. "Stay where you are. Don't move," she texted back. "I'm coming to get you." Skipping the line at Customs and Immigration is impossible. We all know that. If you're late, you miss your flight. That's the rule. That's on you. Being my height made flying brutal, but it did allow me to look clear over the heads of most people. I could see all the way to the back of the terminal, and as I scanned the crowd for any sign of Gabby, I finally saw it. a flag, and not just any flag, a bright orange flag on the end of an 8-foot pole, an 8-foot pole that was attached to the back of a fucking wheelchair that Gabby was pushing through the mob towards me. "Get in," she mouthed to me. Gabby had big hair, but she couldn't have been any taller than 5'2", so I leaned way down and whispered, "There is no fucking way I can get in that thing." "If you want to get on this flight," she whispered back, "get in. It's the only way I can get you to the front of the line." I've been standing with these same people in this same line for 45 minutes. I can't just suddenly need a wheelchair. I just took a picture with a fan. Gabby reached up and pulled me in close by the back of my neck, the same way a mom does when she wants to give you shit for acting out in public. "If you're not going to sit, then you're going to have to limp," she told me. "Can you limp?" "Yeah," I thought. "I can limp." Gabby put my luggage on the seat of that wheelchair and my hand on her shoulder, and I limped my ass to the front of that line and all the way to first class. When I landed in LA, it was a boots on the ground and all hands on deck type situation. I met my producer and cameraman at the airport, and we worked through the night building stories. At sunrise, we made our way to the LA County Coroner's office to grab a good spot for the press conference that was going to start in a few hours. That's when my phone started blowing up again. But nobody had died this time. These were all messages from people I'd worked with over the years but didn't really talk to anymore. And all their emails and texts had the same message: Kiss FM needs a morning show. Years earlier, when my dad was in his last few months, when I was out of work and my marriage was ending, I took a job at Kiss 92.5 FM, a top 40 radio station in Toronto that blew up riding the wave of boy bands, Britney and Christina, and those early seasons of American Idol. The program